We've got so many tools that are available to us that were not available before. And so one of the other things that I've kind of noticed through my journey in this is that a lot of elk hunters, they kind of dabble in some of these tools and they kind of learn the basics of the tools, but they certainly, I shouldn't say the majority, but a significant portion just are not learning the real finer points and the real intricacies of how these platforms work and how they can work together. In your research, you know, it doesn't matter. To me, I don't care how many hunters are there, really. That's not my real number one concern. I know that if I do it right and I work through the process, I can work through that. So I'm not necessarily focused on areas that have less hunters, more hunters, because I'm just gonna be honest with you guys. The more hunters there is, probably means there's more elk. You have to do enough research when you're looking at the statistics for a particular state, no matter what service you're looking on, guys, you have to know how they collect that data. And that needs to be factored into your decision-making. No matter what you do, no matter how you look at it, make sure you're looking at a 3-year or even a 5-year average. I would not go past 5 years, guys, because elk management plans, wolves in some states, there's a lot of factors that can change the elk dramatically over 5 years. So before you get to the elk finding features, one of the first things that I do is I want to identify possible hunt areas. Keep in mind what I just said, possible hunt areas.
What's up, Days in the Wild Nation? Before we get into this next episode, I have a couple of favors to ask of you. I know you heard me say it before, but please take a few moments and go give us a review on iTunes. It really helps me reach more people, helps my ratings, which ultimately helps me keep this podcast free and create content for you guys. If you could also go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags, check out their line of shooting and hunting products. A lot of game-changing stuff on there. And if you use promo code John Stallone, you'll save 20%. John Stallone, all one word. Lastly, if you've been listening to the show, you know that Days in the Wild Podcast and Days in the Wild Outfitters have partnered with Primos. We love their trail cameras, love their ground blinds. We use some of their calls, assortment of other little gadgets here and there. Go check them out. Tons of stuff on their website. If you use promo code STL02, you'll save 15%. Thanks for tuning in, and let's jump into this next episode. We have Mark Livesay.
He's got a very
unique voice, so most of you guys probably recognize if you heard him on my podcast or somebody else's podcast before. But Mark owns Treeline Pursuits, and give us a little rundown about yourself real quick, and then we'll just jump right into it.
All right, John. So it's interesting that I've really never paid that much attention, but people are starting to hear me on podcasts. They say, you're the Tony Robbins of the hunting podcast. I'm like,
Tony Robbins.
I've had 13 throat surgeries in my lifetime. So Jesus. That's part of the problem. So anyway, hopefully people can understand me well. It's pretty unique as far as the voice goes. Thanks for having me on, John. Again, my name is Mark Livesay. You know, I said this earlier when we started recording. I'm originally from Missouri, and I started elk hunting, you know, in my early 20s from Missouri. So I spent over 2 decades traveling from Missouri out to the western states, you know, hunting. And back then, when I first started, you know, hunting elk, Google Earth wasn't even around. That tells you a little bit how old I am. And when Google Earth first came out, it was $399.
Yep.
and I bought it. I was one of the first probably hunters to own that thing. And it really changed the game, as you know, John. You're younger than me, but I don't know that you're a ton younger than me.
45.
You're 6 or 7 years younger than me then. So I used Google Earth, you know, in the beginning, and used topo maps. So it's just I've had coming from the Midwest out to the West is a huge challenge. And I think the guys and girls that live out here, they get a chance to do it, get out, boots on the ground, putting up trail cams, all the things they do, I think they underestimate the historical knowledge that they're gaining by having the ability to do that. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening nowadays is you know, more and more people are applying for tags. I mean, my gosh, you can just look around and see what's happening with that. And especially this last couple of years. So, and they're wanting to try new areas. They're wanting to go to new states. Even the Western guys are wanting to do new areas, new states. So this attention placed on cyber scouting, as you call it, e-scouting, has been pretty intense over the past 5 or 6 years, mainly because Google Earth used to be kind of the only game in town, so to speak, from the digital platform. But now we're going to talk about this. That was one of the questions you asked me before the podcast was, what are some of the technology tools that I'm using and how am I using them, et cetera? Well, they really exploded in the last 5 or 6 years. And we just got, as elk hunters particularly, that's what I'm mainly focused on at this point. We've got so many tools that are available to us that were not available before. And so one of the other things that I've kind of noticed through my journey in this is that a lot of elk hunters, they kind of dabble in some of these tools and they kind of learn the basics of the tools, but they certainly, I shouldn't say the majority, but a significant portion just are not learning the real finer points and the real intricacies of how these platforms work and how they can work together. And so that's, I spent a lot of time in the course, you know, mentioned, so you mentioned I'm the owner of Treeline Pursuits, and I rent llamas. I do a lot of things as far as Treeline Pursuits goes, but I started last year, I started a new venture called Treeline Academy. Mm-hmm. And it's really the basis for this e-scouting masterclass, this e-scouting elk, I should say, masterclass course that I developed about a year ago. It's virtually almost just a year ago it launched. And so I spent 2 or 3 years developing the course and then launched it last year. Basically, it's the culmination of 30 years of e-scouting from the Midwest coming out to the West. So, you know, I'm never going to claim I'm the best elk hunter. I'm never going to claim I killed the biggest elk. That's probably more in your wheelhouse.
Nah, man. I don't kill. I don't kill big shit. I kill okay stuff. Mature animals. That's it.
But what I do, I do have a pretty high success rate, and I do like to hunt new areas all the time. I can't think of in my entire career of elk hunting, probably no more than two, probably a maximum of three times in 30 years, have I ever gone back to the same area. Now, a lot of people be like, whoa, you know, and that's true. I'm just going to stay up front. You're going to have more success if you do learn and work through an area more and more. I do agree with that, and I do endorse that. But I am a serial elk hunter, John. I mean, I love hunting elk, and I can't stop myself from going to new places. I just like, oh, I want to go here. And when I moved to Montana 6 years ago, it was like, I'm a kid in a candy store now. There's so many places. I can't hunt the number of places that I want to hunt in the rest of my lifetime.
Right.
So I don't have time to go back to places I've already been to before, even though there's big elk there, there's even giant elk there. I just have got this desire to keep moving to new places. I love developing new places. And that's kind of where, if I want to say my skills came from, is that I'm on the constant search for new areas, new regions, new units, new states. And for example, one of the last things I'll introduce myself with is I always have, the minimum I try to go for is 3 elk tags a year and at least 3 states. Last year I had 4 states and 5 elk tags.
Wow.
So it was a crazy year. And I killed only 2 of my 5, and now I could have killed 3 of the 5. But one of the reasons I didn't have success on all 5 of my tags was, one, I turned 1 back in because I just couldn't do it. It's too much scheduling issues. Mm-hmm. But the other reason was I didn't spend enough time in each place. I had to move on to the next hunt. Yep. So I kind of screwed myself a little bit. Now, one of the reasons was I drew a couple really nice tags. I drew a New Mexico tag. Oh, nice. For the first time in 20 years since I've had it, this particular unit. So there were some things that happened that I, you know, it just happens when you draw these really nice tags. They just kind of have to get fitted into your scenario. So anyway, that gives you a little bit of background on kind of what I do, how I do it, and why I do it. So
awesome. So basically, you've developed a system based on, you know, how you're hunting to solve a problem for yourself, and now it's teachable, and you got a system that you could teach people, and you know, move that, you know, that knowledge, that 30 years of you doing it for yourself, and putting it into a system that people can apply to the to their own hunts.
Well, and you know, and like you, John, I think you've been hunting elk is probably as close and probably that much time yourself. And I don't think that many people that have been doing it as long have just thought through how they do it, why they do it, and really down to this intricate details. I think a lot of hunters just kind of assume they do things, they just do them, but they don't really know why they're doing them. They're good at, they're incredible elk hunters. I got to talk to Ryan Lampers. I mean, the dude's a giant killer. He's become a really good friend of mine. This dude is probably one of the best hunters I've ever met personally. And if you sit down and talk to him about how he does things, I don't know. But he just knows that he innately, with experience of all of his years, all the places he's been, he innately knows how to accomplish the goals. But what I've tried to do is reverse engineer all these years and I spent a couple of years doing it. And I'd add a little, really look at it. And so the end product was kind of this course, and it's 30 modules long, and it's about almost 30 hours of education. I mean, it's intense. This is not something you're gonna do and take in like a weekend. It's pretty intense. And in some regards, it might be too intense. But if you love getting into that level of detail and you love looking at every aspect and every angle, then this might be your thing. If you don't, it might not. So, yeah, that's kind of how I developed it. And, you know, we can talk to a little bit of content. You sent me some great questions and I made some notes for them. But there's no way we in a one podcast we can kind of cover.
Right. Just take me through the meat and potatoes of what you're doing. And
yeah. So the first question you asked me was, what are some of the technology tools, you know, kind of like, because nowadays that's kind of a big part of it. That's what's really opened the doors for quote e-scouting or cyber scouting, is that the development of all these additional tools. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I do in my course is, and this is where I'm unique, I'm not tooting my own horn, but this is a very, very unique and very important aspect, is I do not accept sponsorship. I do not accept endorsement. I've absolutely decided that's not the way I'm going to go with this. This is an educational tool where I evaluate and give you my 100% unbiased opinion on all of these tools. So when I mention OnX Hunt, I'm telling you what I really think of it, how I use it. It's not because I'm getting paid to endorse their product, getting affiliates, all the stuff that goes. That's not my thing. I'm not interested in that. I charge $119 for my course. And I feel like the guys that want to take my course, they do not want to be sold on a product 1X or product Y. And so I'm pretty hardcore about it. And I live in Missoula, Montana. I'm at the headquarters of OnX. I've been down there several times for product development meetings and new feature launches. And I'm friends with a lot of guys on OnX. So I use OnX because it's the most popular and probably most widely used application. I use it, I mean, extensively. But it's not the only application I use because, in my opinion, OnX has some limitations. Mm-hmm. It has three views. That's it. Topo, hybrid, satellite. Okay, fine. That works for a lot of people. I want more than that. I want multiple topos, and I want multiple area photos, and I want to integrate different aspects. So I use Gaia GPS probably most of the time. It's definitely more complicated. It's the learning curve is bigger, but the resources and tools are significant. But I almost always use OnX as well. Mm-hmm. I never, John, go on a hunt, never, without all of my hunt areas downloaded on two platforms. I just have had too many problems with both applications, mm-hmm. even Basemap, where I've had a messed up download, offline got messed up, or I'll be honest, I've lost my waypoints. They weren't lost, but they weren't visible for some reason.
I've had that before too.
Yeah, these hunts are too important, guys. For an extra $25 to have another program is insurance that I can't believe most elk hunters don't do. So I never will go on elk hunt without a backup hunt platform. Meaning I use Gaia, I use OnX, I've been using Basemap more and more. They are, you know, they're doing a little better, and their system is more stable, and it's doing a better job. But I do not really focus on or recommend one over another. For example, I'm just going to be honest with you. If you guys are hunting an area that private land is really important, and the borders and how they work with the public land is, and that's an integral part of where you're hunting, OnX is your tool. They are the king when it comes to private land and navigating private land situations. Mm-hmm. So I'll use OnX as my primary tool for when I'm needing to accomplish that task. If I'm hunting more remote areas and I'm looking at, I need to really study the terrain, it's really steep, I want the best topographic maps I can get, then I'm using Gaia GPS, because the hybrid version of OnX just doesn't accomplish it. I know I'm spending a lot of time on this, but that's an important part of this course, is learning and developing the technology tools. And not only learning them, but really learning the ins and outs. I have entire modules dedicated to each platform, both the web-based option and the mobile option. So I use Gaia, OnX, Basemap, of course. Google Earth Pro is still my number one e-scouting tool. Mm-hmm. There is nothing better.
The imagery is the best, for sure.
There's just nothing, guys. All these applications, Gaia has it, OnX has it, Basemap has it, the 3D capabilities, okay? It's okay. It's marginal. Now, I'm sure it's going to get better, but it is not at the level of Google Earth Pro. So I'm just saving you some time right now. If you're trying to look at things from a 3D mode, Google Earth Pro is absolute key. What people don't know about Google Earth Pro, and this is a giant part of my course, is that it is so much capable of doing more than people think it can. And we can talk about that a little, or we don't have to get into it, but Google Earth Pro comes, when you install it, it's an aerial photo imagery tool. That's it.
Right.
But when you start adding KML files and shape files and all of these other resources that I talk about, Google Earth becomes an incredible e-scouting tool. Mm-hmm. You can add topographic views to Google Earth. A lot of people don't even know that. It's pretty simple to do. You can add fire layers. You can add cattle allotment, where the cattle are running and where they're not running. You can add logging layers. You can add snow layers. You can add weather layers. You can add all kinds of unit boundaries.
Private lands and unit
boundaries. Private land, public land.
Yep.
You can add motor vehicle use. There's, in some states, you can download the entire motor vehicle use network. And not only do you get that, but you get all the descriptions of when the roads are open, when they're closed, kind of like what, you know, OnX does and these others do. So my point is, if you set Google Earth Pro up properly, it is the most valuable tool when it comes to e-scouting before the hunt. So I'll leave it at that. The other one, another tool that I use in conjunction with Google Earth Pro from time to time, is CalTopo. And there's a lot of features about CalTopo that I use. It's a little different than Google Earth Pro. It has a few features that I really like slope shading, slope analysis. I spend a lot of time talking about what degree or what percent of slopes that elk prefer to hang out on. And so CalTopo really helps me break some of that down. Now, Gaia GPS has a slope layer now, so that's becoming a tool that I can use in Gaia GPS. So those are kind of some web platforms that, I use. Another thing I'm just going to throw out there, because I know people might be making notes here, but don't underestimate, guys, the Google Earth Pro mobile version. Mm-hmm. There's been some significant advances in the last couple of years. So, and more areas that we hunt elk in have decent cell service now. So if you do your research and you know that you're going to have good service, make sure you have your data, a version of your data exported and imported into the mobile version of Google Earth Pro. Because what that does, it gives you really incredible in the field 3D analysis. It's the best 3D modeling that you can get. Yeah. And, but again, it won't work, obviously, if you don't have cell service, but neither will any of the hunt applications. OnX.3D doesn't work without cell, neither does Gaia, none of them do.
Right.
So you might as well have Google Earth installed as well. Don't forget that. It's a really good tool to have. So a few others I use, you know, I know you're a fan of GoHunt.com, at least I think you are. But
I do, yeah.
Man, I use GoHunt, guys, a lot. And I pay for my membership, guys. I pay
same here.
Top up. I get no discount. So I'm just telling you straight up. It's money I spend every year. I absolutely have GoHunt. The other one I absolutely have is TopRut.com. It is an incredible research tool.
I have that as well.
You can use them in conjunction. Like last night, the Colorado deadline, it'll be passed by the time this comes out, is tomorrow. I'm trying to decide on a mule deer unit. I found two major mistakes between GoHunt statistics and TopRut.com. I'm not really going to dwell on it, but my point is I would have never caught it, and I might have applied, and I had virtually no chance of getting a tag, but I wouldn't have known it if I wouldn't have had both of them up. And then when I saw the discrepancy, I went to the regs, I went to the draw statistics and looked at the detail. Sure enough, there's a mistake. So don't think it can't happen, okay? And I'm not trying to throw either one of those under the bus. That's why I'm not going to really get into it. But the point I'm trying to make is having these backup tools, just like I mentioned before about having the two mobile platforms, when I'm doing my research, I like to use GoHunt, TopRut, Hunting Fool, all in conjunction. I'm also dabbling with this new Eastman's Tag Hub. So it has a ways to go. I'm just going to be honest with you. But they do have some things that I am particularly interested in, like year averages. Mm. I love to average years of success and harvest statistics, not looking at just 1 year. And most of these tools only will show you 1 year of data at a time. So I like the idea that Eastman's is doing with that 3 year and 5 year averaging, but they're not quite there yet. It's in development. It's out there, but I just don't feel like it's my only go-to tool. I do realize these cost money, so you might have to pick which ones you want to go with. I get it. But if you really want to be serious, think of the money we spend elk hunting, guys. I mean, the money that we spend on elk hunting compared to what these services cost is very insignificant.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Anyway, enough said about that.
So what is like, let's kind of walk through... You know, obviously, I don't want you to give away. You're not going to give away because you got 30 hours worth of information. But, walk us through like your starting point when you're going to a new area to hunt. Like,
okay, so you asked me in your email, your questions is just what you said. How do I go about initially
right.
finding new areas and units and regions and just how am I breaking it down? That's before we ever even get into what features are we looking for where elk want to be. The first thing I want to know is what units that is the success rate, is the elk herd, is the bull to cow ratio, is all these things, and is the terrain, what elevation bands I'm looking at from different types of seasons. How am I kind of breaking that down? So I look at it several different ways. I'm going to be quick about this and not get too much in the weeds. Because I can give you guys, I think I can at least get you interested if you think so you can start doing some of the research on your own. So I do talk about the application. I have a module in the course called State, Method, Research, and Application Strategy. And so the application season, I know one of the things I just want to say right off the bat is if you're looking to do Arizona stuff, this podcast is the go-to. You have some of the best Arizona analysis I have ever heard. I don't even go anywhere else. I only listen to your podcast when I start trying to look at what I want to do. Now, I have never drawn an Arizona tag.
But, oh, that sucks.
But I'm trying. I'm 16 years into it, and I'm trying. I know I'm going for some pretty nice tags.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just want to throw that out there. It's really incredible information if you're interested in Arizona.
Thank you.
So the application season, I don't spend a ton on the application process in the course because you've got this podcast. You've got Corey Jacobson and Randy Newberg put out some great stuff. There's quite a few resources to look at application season. And the other problem with putting it in a course is it changes all the time.
Right.
So it's a very evolving process. But it is a season now. It is a complicated process. And you have to get your mind around how it works. And you have to understand. It pains me, particularly in Arizona, when I'm putting in every year, how many people I see a non-resident putting in for units that don't even have a non-resident tag.
Right.
They've got no chance of drawing a tag, and they just spent, $250 putting in an application for a unit. There's no chance of getting a tag. Now, unfortunately, Arizona Department of Wildlife, or whatever they call them, they're not going to call you up and say, hey, you're putting in for a unit that doesn't even have a tag.
Nope.
That's your job, right, John? Am I correct on that?
Yep. That is on you.
And you break that typically down
happens
a lot.
That typically happens with your sheep hunts. It's not so. I don't think there is an elk hunt that there isn't a mathematical chance for or not
mathematical. Yeah,
there is a mathematical chance for at least one or two tags in. You know, there's only a few hunts where there's like 20 tags or whatever like that.
Yeah. So
there's 10% of those tags go to non-resident. So right. Now when you're talking about sheep and stuff like that, when there's only one tag, so there's not 10% of one tag, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
there's right. Not a mathematical chance. There's no out-of-state tag. So, but as far as elk hunting is concerned, there isn't a unit that you can put in for in Arizona that I know of. That you can't possibly draw now.
Possibly, but still,
you're putting yourself in a real, if there's 20,000 applicants and there's only one or two tags, then good luck. You know, you got a better chance of winning the lottery. But,
and so there's a lot to it. So, money is the game. I mean, this application stuff is not a cheap endeavor. So you have to understand what you're getting into and how you're doing it. There's a lot of good resources in it. So I talk about it. I allude to a lot of resources like Hunting Pool. Hunting Pool has a pretty decent tag cost application calculator. Mm-hmm. And honestly, Hunting Pool now comes, I'm not promoting this, I'm just telling you facts. It now comes with the Onyx Elite, which is pretty dang nice.
Right.
And so does Top Rut. So you got to get those two services when you get Onyx Hunt Elite. If you're hunting more than one state, you're going to probably get the Elite anyway. So I just thought, I don't know how many people know that yet. It's pretty new, just a few months. So application stuff, there's a lot of stuff out there. I have links to a lot of stuff. John's a great resource for several, especially Arizona. So I don't spend a lot of time on the application stuff itself. When it comes to the research, remember, I want to hunt multiple states each year and I want to have multiple tags. So my entire strategy is designed around that. I put in
designed around opportunity.
Both. My goal is to get 3 elk tags. That's the number one goal. Mm-hmm. But my secondary goal is I'm always putting in for these glory states and these glory tags while I'm doing it. For example, Arizona. Mm-hmm. I've never drawn an Arizona elk tag, and I keep punishing myself because I keep coming down there and hunting the mule deer over the counter January season. Mm-hmm. In the units that I'm trying to draw for elk, And I just see these freaking giant elk running around everywhere, and it just frustrates me to no end. So, but I'm always putting in New Mexico. Guys, I used to draw New Mexico. I know this is going to be hard to believe. I used to draw New Mexico tags every other year.
Right.
Back in the 90s. And now, the last time I drew the unit I just hunted last year was 21 years ago. So it's incredibly hard. And then I just saw something ridiculous. I don't know the number, but I thought they said 60,000 additional people applied for New Mexico than did the year before.
Yep.
This year. We had 30,000.
We had 30,000 here, so I don't know if that's correct or not, but it's probably probably pretty accurate. We had a record breaking last year, and this year we were 30,000 above last year.
Man, so guys, the strategy is important. And that's where this research comes in. So you know, it's one thing to pick a hunt area, pick a unit, but the first thing you got to do is find out where can you actually even get tags, okay? That's job one. So my strategy has two aspects. Like I said, one is to accomplish the aspect of getting tags. Number two, to always have the chance of drawing a few of these really premium glory tags, whatever label you want to put on them. So next thing I want to say about this is there's no magic to this. I don't know what you think, John. There's no magic, guys. There's no secret areas. There's no unknown gems. There's units that may be a little under, but there's
not anymore. Just, not anymore.
Not anymore. Those. Not anymore. No. So do your research. You know, it doesn't matter. To me, I don't care how many hunters are there, really. That's not my real number one concern. I know that if I do it right and I work through the process, I can work through that. So I'm not necessarily focused on areas that have less hunters, more hunters, because I'm just going to be honest with you guys. The more hunters there is probably means there's more elk. And that's not a 100% true statement, but it's not that far from true.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time researching that. So again, I'll go back to the services that I use, and how I do it is Go Hunt. What I use Go Hunt for primarily is draw odds analysis. I use their strategy articles for each state that they put out each year, which are incredible. I use their state regulation summaries. A lot of guys don't realize they even have that. What they do on that particular section is they break the state down as far as the rules and regulations in a real easy, quick way to kind of get it. So I really like that. And just their articles, guys. They put a lot of great articles out about this process. What I also do on Go Hunt is I pay particularly close attention to the comment section. There's guys that say things they probably shouldn't say. There's guys that say that get corrected that are wrong. Uh-huh. So you can learn a lot from just paying attention to those comment sections in these various articles. TopRut.com, one of the reasons I really like that site is it's a spreadsheet type format. It's a little different view than GoHunt.com. So I use those in conjunction. I mentioned that earlier. And I'm just starting this year, I'm starting to use Hunting Fool and, you know, a lot more. Now, I will say that Hunting Fool's statistics are basically TopRut.com. They're identical. I don't know this for sure, but I think they get their statistics from TopRut. They're identical. They look the same. So I think that those two are interchangeable as far as just raw statistical analysis.
So what are those statistics that you're looking at, that you're focusing on? I know you mentioned a little bit earlier, like bull to cow ratio, success rates. What are the numbers that you're looking for that say, hey, this is a unit I need to look into?
Man, so you're following my agenda right on track, like we talked before. So the next point I have is actually the statistics. So what are we looking for? Well, unfortunately, guys, the statistics are not created equal, okay? Various states have mandatory surveys. They have phone. Montana has a freaking phone survey. They call hunters. They pay people to call hunters and survey them. And then when they call me, I've been called a couple of times, they ask me questions like, did you hunt elk, yes or no? What unit did you hunt? Did you kill anything? And that's it. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. And so you have to do enough research when you're looking at the statistics for a particular state, no matter what service you're looking on, guys, you have to know how they collect that data. And that needs to be factored into your decision making. So that's why this is a real big point here. Well, hold on. I'm not going to say this just yet. So some states do, like I said, mandatory. Some states do random. Some states do these phone calls. Some states do just on your honor online submission.
That's Arizona.
So all these different things you have to know, because when they say that so many elk get killed, that's kind of BS. Now, I know that statistically they know what they're doing, and they've got statisticians, I at least hope, that are doing this stuff. So they have some pretty good grasp on what they're doing, but it is not perfect. Keep that in mind, guys. A lot of people don't understand that. They think they look at the stats. That's just what it is. That's not the truth. So what I've done, and this is what I recommend, I talk about this in the course. If you're a serious elk hunter, okay, I'm kind of talking to you. If you are or you want to be, there's really only one way to do this, okay? And it's not going to be fun, but I wrote my own database, and I've spent 5 years writing it, where I import the raw data from all the states that I hunt so that I can do my own analysis on a five-year rolling average. So you don't have to do it in a database. You can do it in a basic Excel spreadsheet. And you may have to hand input the data, which is not that hard to do. Take all the key points of data, put them in your spreadsheet, and get, when you've got statistics, okay, guys, that are not mandatory, and they're not, even when they are mandatory, but when they're done all these varieties of ways, the best way to make them usable is to average them. It's not perfect, but it's better than looking at 1 year. Because I can tell you, I've looked at a lot of units. 1 year, they've got a 25% harvest success. The next year, they got 5. And you're like, what's going on? And part of it may be just a good and bad year. But part of it might be tied to how they collect the data.
Right.
So the averaging is really important. So I spend a lot of time on that, guys. I do. So that's another. So what am I specifically looking for? Obviously, harvest rate's important. So what I did was I developed my own score system. And I score each unit by the data that's available. For example, let's use Montana just because I live here. Montana has a few key points of data. For example, they have harvest success. They have total numbers of bulls killed. They have bulls that are 6 points or better. They have what else? They have cows, calves. They have a few things, okay? So this is a little hard to explain, but I put a factor on each one of those statistics. So what I'm saying is harvest statistics, I take that and I say, okay, anything that is within 1% to 10% gets a number 1. Anything between 10% and 15% gets a 2. I give a score, a 1 to 5 score for each one of those things, okay? Mm-hmm. Based on what I think is a good number. And how I kind of look at that is I look at the highest success rate and I look at the lowest success rate for the entire state, and I come up with a rating scale of 1 to 5. I do that for each one of these specific criteria, bull to cow ratio, all of them. I give them a 1 to 5 score. Then I apply a multiplier to each one of those scores. So harvest rate is a high value data point for me. So let's say it's a 3. That 3 is multiplied by a factor, let's say 5. So 3 times 5 gives me a score of 15 for harvest statistic, for harvest rate. And I do that for each one of those. Guys, it doesn't matter really how you do it. The point is, if you do it, if you take time to do it like this, and then you've got your harvest statistic score of 3 multiplied by your factor, and then you do that for 6 different criteria, and then you add those all up and it gives you a score. Guys, it's eye-opening. It is eye-opening what you'll start to see develop. And then what you'll start to do is you'll go back and you'll start tweaking your formula, and you'll start saying, well, this means more to me. You know, bulls are more important to me than cows, and so I'm going to give it more weight, or this is more weight, or you know, maybe you're just looking for any elk. Well, let's weight that appropriately. There's no statistic report out there that I've ever found that does this or even close to this. Mm-hmm. And it's not that hard to do. You know, with some basic elementary math, you can come up with a formula. And so I spent some time talking about that, how to set that up, but it's really invaluable, especially if you do that and you do it over 5 years and you see that average score for 5 years and you compare 10 units, guys, it's going to be pretty clear to you which units are going to start jumping out.
Yep.
I know I'm not visually showing that. No. And I know it's hard to say that, but did you understand that, John?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I got a very similar style in a lot of ways, maybe not as, in depth as yours. I'll just take a state real quick. If I'm looking at a state and I'm using GoHunt, okay, I'll just use one platform right now just to make it simple. I always start with opportunity. That's my first deciding factor. Okay, what do I possibly have a chance? Which units do I possibly have a chance to draw? Okay, then let's say there's five units that I have a mathematical chance, and it's a pretty good chance above 20%, right, of drawing a tag. I always look at the bull to cow ratio because I know if there's a higher number of bulls to cows, that doesn't mean the population's bigger. It just means that the competition for the bulls is tougher to actually get laid. So
yeah,
I am going to have a better chance of calling one in. I'm going to have a better chance of, you know, fooling one with my mojo. And then, you know, I do look at harvest statistics, but what I look at is to see, is that number at or above what the national average is for harvesting an elk? Or a state average for harvesting an elk. That's all I need to know. Because for me, and this might sound conceited, but if it's at the average, then I know I'm going to kill one. Because
so you're doing exactly what I said in your mind. You're putting your weight based on these different things.
Right, exactly.
But see, John, you've got so much experience that you're able to do that. You're able to kind of, you've come up with your own kind of way based on experience that has worked for you, and you know your abilities, and you've applied your abilities, and you've applied this all into your little package. I love it. And that's exactly what I'm kind of talking about, except some guys don't have that experience to apply.
No. That's why they need something like what you've got.
That's great.
It puts it all in perspective.
For example, like you just said, when it comes to 6-point bulls, I have a pretty high weight on that for me. Uh-huh. So when I do, you know, when I do my multiplication factor, it might be a 7, but harvest statistics might be a 4 multiplier. And I hope I know it, you know. So then when it all adds up, but like you just said, so bull to cow ratio isn't the only thing. If you only look at that, you're screwing yourself.
Right, exactly. Yep.
And if you only look at harvest, I think you're screwing yourself. If you only look at total numbers of hunters, you're going to screw yourself. So I take total numbers of hunters. I take harvest rates. I take bull to cow. I take all of these things into consideration. And then I break them. The last thing I do is I segment that spreadsheet into I can draw, kind of maybe draw, kind of very little chance to draw. So I can kind of break them out into little classes, so to speak, like you just said, just in a, maybe I don't want to say more organized, but in a more visual way. So I know that was a lot of time spent on that, but that's a great way, guys, to kind of start developing your own way to analyze the data that's already out there. For example, Colorado, guys, is got a lot of data, okay, available, but the problem is they're in PDF format. You download these crazy giant PDF files that's got all this data, and they've got every year, they've got 20 years of data, but it's not organized. It's not together. It's not manipulable. So any units that I'm interested in Colorado, I'm hand entering them into my program. I don't do the whole state. Now I might add a unit from time to time, but I will always look. I'm kind of beating a dead horse here, but no matter what you do, no matter how you look at it, make sure you're looking at a 3-year or even a 5-year average. I would not go past 5 years, guys, because elk management plans, wolves in some states, there's a lot of factors that can change the elk dramatically over 5 years. Fires. So I really like to do 3 year averages. Three, five in some cases, but three is about the most relevant time period. Right. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So statistics, that's what I do. The other thing, the next one I spend a lot of time on is a lot of guys, I don't know if they know these exist or these state hunt planners. A lot of the states have their own hunt planners now online. Mm-hmm. Some are fantastic, some are not worth opening. So I kind of go through each one of those and which ones I think are good, which ones I think are bad. So for example, Colorado was not a very good hunt planner, but they have added more stuff now. They've got elk migration data. They got motor vehicle use data. They've got a lot of things in their hunt planner that is really good. So when I mean hunt planners, you can just Google. If you want to, you know, just, I know this is a podcast, so it's hard to be visual here. Just Google Colorado Hunt Atlas, Colorado Hunt Planners, Montana Hunt, and you'll start to see these pop up. There, it's easier to Google for them than it is maybe even go to the state websites and find them. Oh, yeah,
for sure, because you go down a rabbit hole to try to find
them. Exactly. So don't underestimate these hunt planners. So the next thing that I do in my research, again, I know I'm not getting into the weeds on these. I just want to introduce you to the concepts of what I try to do is almost every state that has elk produces state population and elk objective reports. Like they have units or regions that they say elk are above or below management levels. And those are really good. Now you have to keep in mind that most of the counts are done in January in the migration periods. So you got to be careful about that in some states. Arizona, great. They don't migrate a whole lot in Arizona. New Mexico, et cetera. But in Montana, yes. Wyoming, yes. Colorado, yes. So keep that all in mind. But these objective reports are really good. They're not written for hunters. They're written for kind of research and management. But these reports can give you great bull-to-cow stuff. They can show you some great trends to see kind of if the areas are kind of on the upswing or if they're on the downswing. I always factor those in. Mm-hmm. And what goes in conjunction with those is every state has them. Sometimes they're incredibly hard to find. I've even had to request them. I couldn't find, for example, Montana just redid their website, okay? And it was gone. So I just emailed them. I said, hey, I need the elk management report from this year, from the most recent elk management report. She emailed it to me, or whoever emailed it to me. It's not on the website, but I just asked for it. And these elk management reports are different than objective reports. Now, some of these elk management reports have the objective reports included, but the elk management reports are really great because they are written, and some of these things are freaking extensive, like 200 pages some states. They give you so much information. They talk about GPS collared elk, where they're at, what they're doing. They talk about all kinds of habitat. Issues. They are great tools, guys, and not many hunters talk about them. If you read through the elk management report for your state, I guarantee you, you're going to walk away with an incredible increase in your historical knowledge. And then when you start looking at units, things just start coming together. If you just start staring at statistics and you start staring at numbers,
sometimes it doesn't make sense.
It gets a little mumbly.
Right.
But when you start looking at statistics and looking at hunt planners and looking at objective reports and looking at management reports, this stuff starts really making sense. And so kind of the last thing I want to make sure that I get in there is don't just look at this stuff randomly. Keep good notes. Keep good organization. Write this stuff down. You're never going to remember all the stuff. You see something that catches you, write it down. And I have been blown away myself. I've gone back and read through my notes and how just stuff that I didn't kind of get right when I did started jumping out at me. So I know that sounds like a lot, but it's really not. And it's stuff you can do all through the year. We just talked about this a lot. A lot of people don't do a lot of work until they find out they draw a tag.
Right.
And so that's just some of the, that's kind of the list of kind of what I go through when I'm breaking down areas. I'm looking for places that I want to hunt. And then when I get that, you say I get my top three or whatever, doesn't matter. Then it comes down to how to choose the spots within those areas.
Yeah. Let's switch gears a little bit just because of time wise, but
sure.
Let's say you've drawn a tag. What is it that you're looking for within that unit to choose your actual hunting spot?
Okay. Now this is really where the meat of it, this is where 80% of the course, the 30 hours is dedicated to this. I call it in the course, I call it elk finding features. So before you get to the elk finding features, one of the first things that I do is I want to identify possible hunt areas. Keep in mind what I just said, possible hunt areas. So what I will do is I will look big picture. I will get out a national forest map. I will get big picture Google Earth. I will start flying over, you know, I just start looking at it. I just start visualizing it. I'll start looking at north slopes. I'll start looking at just how the meadows and feeding areas are laying out. Just no, nothing specific. I'm just looking at the broad overview, because before you get into the weeds, you got to see the big picture in my mind. So I want to just see it. I want to feel it. I kind of want to move around it. I'll tell you a great tool. It's a very subtle tool. Toprut.com has a flyover feature for every unit. It's really incredible. Mm-hmm. You can go to Toprut.com. There's a little movie thing. You can hit fly the unit, and it will fly at about 1,000 feet above at a 60-degree angle, and it will fly the perimeter of that unit. And I will put that in very slow motion. I'll sit back in my chair, and I will fly that unit 3 or 4 times from Google Earth perspective. And just looking at the layout, looking at how the peaks and the valleys and the ridge lines, how they come together, where they meet, saddles, just I'm just getting, guys, nothing specific. What I'm trying to do here is expand my historical knowledge of this unit. Before I start like this trailhead, that trail, I don't care where the roads are. I don't care about any of that stuff at this point. So that's how I start. And then as I find areas, what I do is I take my polygon tool, you know, the area tool in Google Earth, and I will just do a quick polygon around an area that just looks interesting for whatever reason. And then that just sits there. Okay. I don't do anything more with it. I just let it sit there. Like for example, I'm doing this right now for my Colorado mule deer draw. I'm trying to decide what unit. So I'm just doing this quick flyover. I've got 2 or 3 that I really like. I'm just seeing which hunt areas are attracting to me. I'm not really getting in the weeds, but I'm just dropping these polygons. Well, I've got 2 units already that have like 6 polygons in them. I'm like, ooh, I like that because there's 6 areas I'm interested in. And this other unit, I only have like 1 or 2. Now, they could be amazing. I'm not saying that just because there's more means it's better. I'm just opening your eyes to a few things. So the next thing I do after I do that, there's a lot more to it than that, but that's kind of that. The next thing I do, because I know we're on time crunch here, mm-hmm. One of the biggest portions of the course, I think, and the most important, is identifying and establishing the zones of pressure. I don't think a lot of elk hunters spend enough time or even near enough time really analyzing where the pressure is going to come from, how it's going to work with that unit, how difficult access this unit is, what difficulty of the terrain is, how many trailheads, access points are there, what the road network looks like, how many motorcycle trails there are, how many non-motorized use areas there are. And really, I'll take an entire unit, John, and I will do a complete pressure analysis for that whole unit. And I go through a very exhaustive way of the way I do it. So basically, in a nutshell, what I'm doing is I'm identifying all access points. And when I say access point, how I classify those is campgrounds, trailheads, and dead ends, and any other obvious takeoff points for people. Mm-hmm. Vehicle roads. I want to know every road that's open and closed. And not just using OnX, because they are not correct all the time. They're just not, guys. Trust me on this. I download the motor vehicle use PDF from the forest that I'm in, and I trace every one of those roads on a national forest map. Huh. It takes time, but I do it for every unit. Private land integration. Next thing I do, I look at all the borders of the private land, where they're at. Does it look like there's at roads through that private land? Are people accessing the public land through the private? I'm analyzing that in this step. The other thing I do, I spend a lot of time on this. People think I'm crazy, but this is freaking a really, really good tool. I use Google Earth Pro to look at all the trail pressure and access point and now pressure. What I do, what I mean by that is I'll zoom in on every trailhead, every trailhead. I will try to find in the historical slider, I will try to find imagery from September or October, whatever month I'm hunting. How many cars are parked there? What's it look like? Does it look like the Walmart parking lot, or does it look like just a dead end road with just a few pull-off spots?
That's a good one.
Guys, that's that is money.
You taught me something. That's a good one.
Dude, I pulled up the trailhead that looked like freaking Walmart before.
Yeah.
And then I looked on Google Earth. I'm like, damn it, Mark. It was right there the whole time.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean I'm not going there. That doesn't mean anything.
Right.
I just want to know it. You know, I just want to know it. And it all goes into the hopper, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So the last thing I do, I have an entire module dedicated to hunt parameters. So the last thing I do is I look at my realities. I look at my limitations. I look at my fitness. I look at kind of what is my hunt parameter, meaning what I mean by that is how far can I go as a hunter from if I'm backpacking, if I'm using my llamas, whatever. Because, guys, it makes no sense at all. I mean, zero sense to e-scout areas that you cannot hunt. I know guys that do that all the time. They get to a spot and they're like, oh, shit, I can't get to there. And you got to understand that. And so I do a radius. I do a, let's say it's 5 miles. I do a 5 mile radius in Google Earth and the radius circle tool. And I place that at every takeoff point. Mm-hmm. And I start to see where I can reach. And then I go back and I start putting 1 mile buffers around all roads. I put a 2 mile buffer. This is my personal. It can be whatever you want, guys. Uh-huh. But I do a 2 mile buffer around all access points. And I do a 1 mile buffer around all roads. So I like to get a little more remote. That doesn't mean there's not elk right by the road, guys. That does not mean that. I'm just saying I have found that calling elk, dealing with elk, I like them less pressured. That's just my personal preference. Mm-hmm. So that's how I break it. I do a 2 mile circle. I do a radius. I actually do on the National Forest map with a elementary compass and pencil. I know that sounds so crazy, but I'm just going to tell you, by the time you do all these circles and you do all these buffers, where you want to hunt is going to become clear. I mean, it's going to become crystal clear, but it's not going to be clear if you just stand there and stare at that map.
Oh yeah.
The other thing that's going to become clear, I've made this mistake, and John, I know you have, you've been out before, but how many times have you hiked into an area? I went 6 miles in with my llamas one time, and I'm 6-7 miles in. I ran into a dude with jeans on and tennis shoes. I'm like, dude, what's going on? Oh, I'm like, where the hell did you come from? Oh, over the ridge. I parked. Right. I'm like, what? And, you know, I missed that spot. Yeah. I missed an access point. So it's not the end of the world, but I want to know where those are at.
Yeah.
So by spending the time doing this, you're going to have less chance of that happening. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So anyway, that's the zones of pressure. I go through that whole process. And it's pretty lengthy before I start looking for the features, you know, benches and metal, all the different elk finding features that I talk about.
Yeah. I actually want to, because I want to kind of get into that and we don't have enough time on this episode, I want to invite you back
part two.
And do a part two. And we should talk about the elk finding features. I think that's a big thing. I think a lot of guys, including myself, you know, and I've got a lot of experience using these tools. It's hard to look at a 3D, hard to even look, you know, at an aerial, and even harder to look at a topo and say, this is, you know, bedding area, this is feeding, this is, you know, travel corridor. This is, you know, those things, a lot of that stuff comes with experience. So, you know, how do you shorten the curve? How do you teach people what to look for? I'm sure that's in your modules, but, you know, I'd like to attack that from a, you know, 30,000 foot view and kind of give guys some ideas of what they're looking at when they're looking through this stuff.
Well, let's give a little prep real quick before we get off of what we might cover here in part two. So you asked me the question, like you just said, how are you deciphering what's bedding, feed, and travel? I'm assuming travel corridors, yeah, on a satellite or aerial photo view, right?
Right.
Well, I gave up on that years ago. Like you just said, it's incredibly difficult to do it. But what's not incredibly difficult to do is I look for specific features that elk are attracted to.
Okay.
And when you start seeing these features, and we'll talk about these, there's 10 of them. When you get the 10 features identified in a hunt area, what you're looking for, the way I do it, Jan, is I identify all these features, and then I start looking for clusters. Where are these meadows that are close to these benches that I'm looking for that meet certain criterias, that are near these saddles that I'm looking for that meet these certain criterias, that have these drainages that meet these certain criterias? When I start seeing areas that have 4 or 5 out of 10, I'm like, that's where the elk are going to be. I don't look for a good meadow. I don't look for a good bench. I don't look for a good saddle. Yeah. I look for the combination of those. That's what's been a winning formula for me, is that I kind of, now if I can identify what I think is an amazing bedding area, or of course, but as you just said, that is not, that's easier said than done.
Right.
And what I want to see, and we'll talk a lot about this in part two, is I want to see multiple elk finding features that are in relatively close proximity that have a natural working pattern. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That's a lot of what I do. It's called juxtaposition. You know,
and see, you're one of those guys, I love talking about this because you're exactly what I talk about in the course. Guys that have a lot of experience hunting elk, like you do, don't even realize they're doing it. And when they talk to other guys, they kind of leave that part out because that's just what they do. They don't think it's a big deal. They just think everybody knows it. It's like, well, it's pretty freaking obvious. Well, it's not obvious to the beginner elk hunter.
Right.
Not always obvious anyway, I should say. And so anyway, yeah, that's kind of the way it works.
Well, awesome. Well, I think we'll cut it off right there. And I definitely want to have you back on for part two. And we'll dive into some of these features and why we're looking at them and what makes them elk attracting features. So in the meantime, guys, go check out Mark's stuff and start looking into that course. What's the website?
So the course is at, you can read a lot about it, and actually you can take a couple of the modules for free just to kind of check it out. But it's treelineacademy.net, and you can check that out, or even treelinepursuits.com, and you can link to it from there as well. You can also message me on Instagram. I do Facebook, but I'm not as active on Facebook as I am on Instagram, but it's just treeline_pursuits. And so that's basically it. Thanks for having me, John. It was really good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we'll talk to you soon, and we'll get that podcast number two rolling here pretty soon.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
All right, buddy. Thanks.
Well, that's it for this episode. But before I let you go, I have one more thing to ask of you. I want you to take a serious look at your relationship with hunting and the outdoors, and what it really means to you. Now I want you to picture if all that goes away. Not a great picture, right? It's important for us hunters to stick together and have one unified voice. We need to stand for each other, and not just when it affects us or what we do, not when it's just convenient, but really stand up with each other, lock arms, and anytime someone comes to challenge our heritage, we make one unified voice. We are stronger together. Remember that. I promise you, that if you stand up with your fellow hunters, even if it's something you don't do, I know I brought up this in my podcast several times about deer hunters not caring about lion hunters and not caring about, you know, bear hunters and so on and so forth. It doesn't matter if it's something that you do. If you're not a turkey hunter, you're not a bear hunter, you're not a lion hunter, it doesn't matter. You're a hunter, you're a sportsman. You need to stick together. I promise you, if you do that, we are strong and our voice is loud and they will not come for what you love. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next one.